dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people whose intelligence about a particular portfolio in that war that I value more than Kevin Freeman, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, the founder of GlobalEconomicWarfare.com. Kevin is also the author of two terrific books, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, and Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. Kevin is soon to be the host of a brand new program at the Blaze Network entitled Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. It's so good to have you, and thank you very much for giving us a full hour of your time. I've always regretted that there isn't nearly enough in a 10-minute segment to do justice to your very important work and the battle space in which you operate. So this is a great treat to have you for the full hour. Thank you for giving so generously of your time, as I say.
Oh, happy to do it. Always glad to be a part of this.
Good. Well, let me ask you about a topic about which I know literally nothing. In fact, until just recently, I hadn't even heard of it. I try to stay abreast of nasty things, but tell me about the quantum computing threat, what it is and why it poses a threat.
Well, quantum computing is the next advance in computing technology, and it's huge, and it's got the potential to go all the way up to a Terminator-type situation or Matrix, you know, all the disaster movies of the future that we've seen. But in the near term, it has real implications for things like cyber attacks and hacking the network, breaking encryption. The NSA is heavily involved and very concerned. DARPA has been funding advances in this. But there's a digital arms race around the world built on this idea of quantum computing versus traditional computing.
And what constitutes quantum? Is it an amassing of supercomputers that makes them a quantum leap into computing power? Is that the idea?
Well, it's the fundamental architecture of the computer itself. We all know from high school and college where we learned about what a basic computer is comparing ones and zeros. So everything was a bit, and it's either a one or a zero, and the computer just with brute force strength is able to tell which is which. And it used to be done on punch cards, and now it's done on chips, but it's very advanced. But it all comes down to a one or a zero, which is like two ends of a line, and you can have one or the other. But quantum computing goes beyond that. Quantum computing is more than this, but just think initially, what if it's not 0.0 to 1, but it's 0.1 or 0.0005 or 0.0007 or 0.65. All of that opening up of all the numbers in between 0 and 1 is one of the kind of ways that you could imagine. Maybe a better way to describe quantum computing is the capturing of information. If you took a sphere and you had poles on it, like a north pole and a south pole, like the Earth, but just a ball that had a pole, traditional computing would be either the north pole or the south pole, 1 or 0. Quantum computing could be any point on any part of that sphere. And the comparison of one point to another has an infinite level of ability to store information. And what the relationship between any of those two points is an entanglement, a quantum entanglement. It's all based on quantum mechanics. But it means a computer recently tested early prototype tested by NASA and by Google is 100 million times faster than a traditional computer.
So this makes possible, just so we're clear, a degree of computing power and therefore decryption capability against encryption techniques that have been built for the current generation of computers. Presumably it's a boon to outfits like the National Security Agency that are always trying to unravel other people's encryption, particularly, we hope, enemies of this country. But Kevin, is that what you're talking about when you warn about this cyber encryption threat or computing threat? Or is there something beyond that? You mentioned the Matrix and Doomsday sort of scenarios from Hollywood. Explore that a little bit with us, if you would.
Sure. Well, the near-term concern of the NSA and the near-term potential is whoever cracks this quantum computing code first will not only have the ability to crack everybody else's traditional encryption algorithms in a matter of seconds, but also will be able to create uncrackable encryption for themselves. So the fear, the concern is that China, through intellectual property theft, steals quantum computing capabilities and they beat us in the arms race. So that's the near-term threat, is the ability to encrypt or decrypt. But further out, and you get artificial intelligence. You get the ability to create soldiers that operate at a, Terminator-like intelligence, and even the ability to understand or craft subatomic manipulation of elements so that you see the molten men of Terminator. That's science fiction, but with quantum computing, it might entirely be possible as science is advancing. So you get warnings from people like Elon Musk, the great pioneer. He's got Tesla, and he's just a brilliant man. He and Stephen Hawking and Bill Gates are all warning that artificial intelligence, the singularity, so to speak, could happen. And when it does, it changes fundamentally the world. We unleash a technological Pandora's box that could wipe out humanity. And so those are real concerns, but they all start with this idea of quantum computing. Without that, it's unlikely that we would ever achieve either the great potential future that we could have, which would be to manipulate atoms and build things and amazing, do positive things, or the destructive Hollywood-style Armageddon films. But it all begins with this quantum computing, and we're getting much closer every day.
This is fascinating stuff, Kevin Freeman. And as you know better than most, I'm a very IT-challenged kind of guy. So I'm trying to wrap my head around this. But just to clarify, when you talk about sort of future soldiers, are you talking about virtual soldiers? Are you talking about literally human beings who are turned into these Terminators? Or is it some combination, exoskeletons and the like, that sort of are currently being discussed, but could presumably rise to a whole new level of capability with this kind of power behind it?
Well, in any of the above, once you have the computing power, then you can literally, you could create robot soldiers that, right now this kind of computational artificial intelligence is being talked about from all running the entire gamut. From in Japan, there's an entire industry built on sex robots and that. But you could take that same technology and take it in and make it robot soldiers that would be faster, better, stronger in every way than a human soldier. Drone technology that would be far advanced on anything, and it could be managed from one single quantum computer potentially and have impact around the world. So all of that, and I'm not an alarmist, but I am a enjoyer of these Hollywood films. But the more I dig into quantum computing from a cyber encryption and cyber defense standpoint, the more I realize this, there really is potential here. That's why people like Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, and Bill Gates are all very concerned about it.
Kevin Freeman, we're going to turn next, if I may, with you to what is the current state of play with respect to the oil business and the supply glut and what the Saudis are up to and what it means for us. Economic Warfare 2.0 with Kevin Freeman, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Kevin Freeman, our senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy for Economic Warfare. Kevin is a renaissance man on these matters, a certified financial analyst by training and highly capable in the business side of the economy. But he is also one of those who has applied his skills to understanding and helping the rest of us make sense of the national security implications of much of what's going on in the financial and economic sectors. And of course, one of the places where that's particularly in play, Kevin, as you know, at the moment is the oil market. The president, of course, has been cultivating a relationship with the Saudis. They say that they are trying to wean their economy off of oil. I can't tell whether they've given up on trying to destroy our fracking industry, which was their stated purpose when they started flooding the oil market with cheap oil. Give us your read on what Saudi is up to at the moment and what it means for us.
Well, primarily, it appears that the Saudis have not only waved the white flag, perhaps they haven't even waved it, they have just recognized that they are no longer in control of the global energy markets. And they're very concerned. They're cash poor, as it were. They're resource rich. They've got, you know, hundreds of billions of barrels of oil in reserves at Saudi Aramco. I think the figure I saw in Wall Street Journal was $261 billion. They estimate that if they offer Saudi Aramco that the value of the market capitalization of that energy company, which is the Saudi oil company, it would be worth something like $3 trillion, which for the 20th largest economy in the world, that's a lot. But you have to be able to sell that oil, and you have to have the time in which to sell it. I think their economy runs about $600 billion a year, and they have $3 trillion worth of reserves. They need to be able to sell that energy, and they realize that they've unleashed this entrepreneurial spirit in the United States, and because they flooded the market with oil in an attempt to drive prices down, they forced American producers to be far more efficient. So they really are in a quandary.
They did not destroy the fracking industry here in the United States, thank God. But they have apparently put themselves in a position to influence what's done with the outputs of that and other oil sources. Talk a little bit about this Saudi purchase of the largest oil refinery in the United States and its implications.
Well, it makes a logical purchase from an economic standpoint if you realize that you're no longer going to be the export powerhouse sending oil to the United States, and the U.S. economy is the strongest in the world of the large economies. Then how do you participate in the use of energy where you have to own the refineries, you have to own some of the transportation or something? So it logically makes sense. But unfortunately, having a foreign power that has recently admitted that they wanted to destroy our fracking industry, buy a part of our infrastructure, makes absolutely no sense to me as an American. Why would you let this group, this nation that said they want to destroy us in our energy development, control our refineries? It makes no sense at all.
No, it doesn't. And deeply worrying in point of fact that we've, I guess, actually allowed this to happen without even a proper review by the so-called Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. Is that right?
Well, it appears it's ridiculous, and we also have the threat of Venezuela collapsing and their ownership of some of our energy infrastructure through Citgo, and we're watching essentially what appear to be commercial transactions, but they really are positioning potential enemies inside our wire.
Yeah, in that case, of course, Russia being a case in point. We'll talk maybe in a moment about Venezuela a bit more, Kevin Freeman, but just staying with this issue of the Saudis, you mentioned Saudi Aramco. As a certified financial analyst, I know you're tracking developments in the stock market, the effort to bring an IPO to market by the Saudis. Walk us through what the implications of that are, Kevin. That suggests a degree of penetration of our market and recruiting large numbers of people who are going to be only too happy to make various commissions on transactions as their helpmates and perhaps their apologists and enablers. Is this a concern?
Well, we saw this same pattern with Alibaba, and it was the largest initial public offering, IPO, in the history of the world, and they took $25 billion of mostly American investor money, and they stuck it in a Cayman Islands corporation that has no shareholder rights whatsoever in Alibaba, and then they used that money to turn around and buy up American technology. There's little doubt in my mind that the Saudis that received this capital infusion from American investors will use it in ways that that perhaps we're not comfortable with. Just as an example, what we're doing is we would be giving them cash near a market peak, and they would be giving us shares of Aramco that have absolutely no influence. But you look at the history of Aramco, this was originally American oil companies in there developing in the Saudi desert, developing their oil fields, and then it got nationalized, just like in all of these other places. And now they're going to sell us a piece of that back, take our cash at a market peak, and who knows what they'll do with the cash.
If history is any guide, I guess, and it should be, we've seen this movie before. It's likely not to work out to our benefit, either on the ground over there in Saudi Arabia or what they do with the cash. And Kevin, you have, again, a familiarity with some of the players. Goldman Sachs is often mentioned as one of the large financial houses on Wall Street that will stand to benefit immensely, probably billions of dollars for handling transactions associated with this IPO of Saudi Aramco. The fact that you have a number of prominent people from Goldman in the Obama administration has been a subject for some concern, shall we say, before this. Should we be more concerned as this transaction goes forward by virtue of that kind of affiliation, past if not present?
Well, both past and present. And Goldman Sachs has an influence, and they are willing to make a buck wherever in the world they can. For example, they bought some of these Venezuelan bonds that are, you know, quite risky. And so Goldman Sachs is not afraid to tread into these international waters, and they're looking out with a profit motivation. They don't have a "we're American citizens, we're patriotic, wave the flag and salute." They do send people to the current Treasury Secretary and all of the prior Treasury Secretaries have all had some ties.
Exactly. Chairman of the Economic Council.
Absolutely. They all have Goldman ties, and they're loyal to Goldman. Hopefully, they're more loyal to the United States, and that's why they were selected for the position. But yes, Goldman is interested in making money, and they're not looking at the long-term national consequences because they view themselves as an international entity.
A third is Dina Habib Powell, from the Deputy National Security Advisor as well. Kevin, I know you'll be following this very closely, and with your help, so will we. I do want to talk a little bit with you as well about something else that the Saudis have been engaged in of late, not singularly, but I think they're in a lead position on it for sure, and that is the effort to blockade and otherwise act against Qatar, one of their neighbors in the Persian Gulf. I'm very keen to hear what your thoughts are. It seems as though this is economic warfare of an almost kinetic kind, actually, and I want to discuss where this is likely to lead as you see it for the countries most immediately involved. We'll talk about that and more with Kevin Freeman right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back in the third installment of our conversation with Kevin Freeman, the soon-to-be star of a new program on the Blaze television network called Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin is also a very important contributor to the public policy debate, notably through his blog at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin, let's pursue this question as to what the Saudis are up to with respect to Qatar. What do they hope to accomplish? What have they accomplished so far? And where do you think it's likely to go from here?
Well, the positive aspect, I mean, you can look at it from the optimist or the pessimist, and the optimist is that they've called Qatar out as one of the largest funders of terrorism, that they've been playing both sides of the street. They've been playing the global push by Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and others to participate properly in the financial systems of the world. At the same time, they have been supporters of terrorism, harbors of fugitives, supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, and groups like that. And so the positive would be maybe the Saudis and Egypt and UAE have gotten the president's message when he said, you've got to stop funding terrorism. So they said, fine, we're going to call it out and we're going to blockade Qatar until they start doing the right thing. That would be the positive side. And for that, I'm all in favor.
Well, drive them out was, of course, a refrain that he was very much emphasizing, and driving them out of the Gulf Cooperative Council, perhaps, or at the very least trying to reduce their ability to engage in the kind of activities that have caused clearly the Saudis and others in that region grief, but also us, notably, but not exclusively, their support for the violent kind of jihad and also the civilization jihad. And Kevin, of course, as an economic warfare kind of guy, I'm sure you appreciate that one of the places that is very much in play in connection with all of this is the rather large U.S. military complex in Qatar. Is there talk of moving it out of there, or is that something that the Trump administration hopes will not be required, but nonetheless is also hoping that Qatar will mend its ways?
I think you've got it in the latter, but I'm by no means the expert on this, but you just pick up the public statements from the Secretary of State Tillerson, and you realize that the Trump administration is trying to thread the needle in a sense. They would like to retain Qatar as a partner, but they absolutely require that they mend their ways, that they no longer harbor. And it's the civilization jihad as well as the active funding of terrorism. And beyond the civilization jihad, as we've talked about, it was out of Qatar that this guy Qaradawi from the Muslim Brotherhood sat on a Sharia-compliant sovereign wealth fund and was instrumentally involved in the failure of Lehman Brothers and via Barclays Bank and the unwillingness of Barclays Bank to rescue Lehman that caused the 2008 financial collapse. So I'm very concerned about what happens there. They've been playing all sides of this, and it appears profiting from all sides of it. And we have a base there, and we want, no doubt, would like to retain our base there, but we can't abide by their bad acting.
Well, that's the rub. And I guess if you want to effect change, and I guess the only real change that one could hope for is the change of government, and that we will, in fact, by pressuring them with threats of removing our base, make that more likely. Is that how you see it, Kevin, that we ought to be striving to remove this rather aggressively hostile emir, or at least one who plays a very aggressive double game, shall we say.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt that he's playing a double game, and he's pretending to the West that he's very Western, and he's pretending then to the jihadists. And he was behind much of the funding for the Arab Spring, and so any of the nations that were affected by that or threatened by that have got to be concerned that there was this big Muslim Brotherhood push, and that's why the Muslim Brotherhood, you know better than I, they've been declared a terror group in several of these nations.
Kevin, one other factor that seems to be operating, particularly for the Saudis and the Egyptians, and I presume others as well, has been an alignment, it seems, between Qatar and the Iranians. What do you know about that, and how much of a factor is it, as you see it, and what's that likely to mean if the pressure is stepped up and the government there changes? Are we likely to see Iranian intervention? I'm told there are Iranian security forces on the ground in Qatar. Don't know if you know if that's true or not, but I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Well, and that's the pessimistic view. You know, I said here's the optimistic view, they're dealing with terror. The pessimistic view is that this is just a microcosm of a much larger ongoing conflict, which involves the Iranians, and that Iran and Qatar have become allies despite potential theological differences, because they're both radicalized. And then there's this whole issue of the terror attack that was in Tehran that was linked to ISIS, and they accused the Saudis. So this appears pessimistically, if you look from that lens, this appears to be the beginning of a very major regional conflict. It's the next move in that could erupt in a global problem. So I do believe that the Iranians and the Qataris have been working together, and I do believe that it needs to end. It needs to be, and that's what this is about.
Another very important factor in this equation. Kevin, switching gears one more time, let me take advantage of your sort of all-seeing eye at globaleconomicwarfare.com. You mentioned earlier the Russians' involvement with Venezuela, specifically in seeking to obtain the assets that are here in the United States, several oil refineries, gas pipelines, offload terminals, and the like. Beyond that, Kevin, the Russians apparently have been stocking the Venezuelan military's arsenal with thousands and thousands of surface-to-air missiles, which, of course, as you know, are extraordinarily dangerous in the wrong hands, even for commercial aircraft. Give us your sense of where this is headed in Venezuela, Kevin. It's clearly an economic freefall, but that's been true for some time. It's got people in the streets. But should this go seriously south, are we likely to see a threat emerging from there, even to things like, civil aviation?
Well, I saw one article suggestion that Venezuela has 5,000 Russian surface-to-air manpad missiles. And if they had 5,000 of those, and they're desperate for currency, any kind of hard currency, just to pay salaries, provide food or whatever, people who are desperate, they will sell anything. Now, the Russians have placed them there, and Russia is certainly going to give them capital in exchange for the oil refineries, and that's dangerous enough. But what if terror groups walk in with money to buy these missiles? How do we protect? What if it's become almost a narco state of Venezuela, because they kicked the DEA out under Hugo Chavez, and they've been dealing with drug cartels virtually running it. What if the drug cartels have these very sophisticated military weapons? What would they do in retaliation? What would they do to cause problems? So yes, as if those proliferate around the world, 5,000 of those, each one, any one of them capable of taking down an airplane, just imagine the threat and the problem that could be. It's a serious problem, and it's something that somebody needs to get in and address quickly.
It has stunning economic implications as well as obviously security ones. If airlines are unwilling to fly in certain parts of the world, or for that matter, find themselves under assault worldwide, it's a stunning, stunning problem. Kevin Freeman thinks things like this through all the time. Check it out at Kevin's terrific blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com, and stay tuned for our next segment, where we'll talk with Kevin about the latest on Russian cyber warfare and others, including against, it appears, the Heritage Foundation. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for our final installment of this special conversation with Kevin Freeman. He is a man that I've come to rely on for his insights and acumen with respect to a whole host of things, but most especially our economic security interests, the subject of a new weekly program that Kevin will be featured in at the Blaze Network starting a little later this summer, called Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin, one of the things that you have brought to my attention is a recent report that whoever it was, and frankly it's not entirely clear who it was, who went into the Democratic National Committee's computer systems last year, also was trying to get into the computer hardware, software, both of the Heritage Foundation. What do we know about who these masked men were and what they were trying to do at Heritage, and did they succeed?
Well, first off, it came from an FBI memo that was confirmed, I believe, by former head of the Heritage Foundation, Jim DeMint, the senator, who confirmed that whoever was attacking the DNC appeared to have been trying to get in unsuccessfully, I happily report, into the Heritage Foundation. They'd used phishing emails, the same kind of phishing emails that were used, virtually identical to the ones that were used with the DNC. And as a result, they weren't able to get in. Good news. The bad news is Heritage Foundation had a database on all potential nominees for Trump administration positions. So it is like a pre-Office of Personnel Management hack. They hack this and they know who all would be eligible to go into, and of course, as you know, having served in the administration, when you apply for jobs, they ask all kinds of information. They retain files and databases and so forth. It would have been very dangerous if they'd gotten it.
And Kevin, the thing that is interesting is, as we've been talking about with others, including most recently, I think, Diana West, is it is stunning that the analysis of the cyber attack in the Democratic National Committee's computer systems is based not on forensic analysis by the FBI, but on the basis of a contractor to the DNC's report. To the extent that there is this close similarity between what's known about the DNC and the Heritage attacks, I presume that the Heritage Foundation has permitted the FBI to actually have access to their hardware, software, what have you, something that the DNC evidently did not do. And that might give rise actually to greater confidence about who was involved.
Well, the reason that they say that it's the same person is that they were substantially similar phishing emails that were sent in. But we don't know. To your point and Diana West's point is that we don't know because the FBI has not been able to look at those computers, and in fact the we know those DNC staffers or those that were working for Wasserman Schultz at the time, they have been called out. One fled to Pakistan, so we don't know. What I do find interesting is if it was the same group and they went after the DNC but also after the Heritage validation, you might not jump to that quick conclusion this was a group trying to get Donald Trump elected. And we know that the RNC was attacked as well. Apparently they didn't get in at the RNC either. But it does not appear then that it was someone colluding to try and elect Donald Trump.
Kevin, one of the things that you focused on, I think very importantly, in your book, Game Plan, is the extent to which our electric grid is highly vulnerable to attack. And I wonder if you've given any thought to the latest report that the Russians have built weapons that apparently have been optimized, cyber weapons, that is, optimized for taking down our grid. What do you know about that, and how seriously should we take not just the threat, but the need to make our grid more resilient?
Well, apparently, and this was reported in the Washington Post yesterday, that the Russian government or hackers allied with the Russian government have developed a weapon called Crash Override. And it may have been used in the Ukraine. And that, as they've analyzed what took place there, it's called a game changer. It's the kind of thing where they can point to, just like they have a super EMP weapon that could take out the grid, now they may have a cyber weapon that we're not prepared for. So it's very frightening. It fits with what we've talked about for years, that other nations are developing these weapons, and we have a responsibility, therefore, to develop protections and defenses for them.
Kevin Freeman, let me turn finally to economics to talk about the relationship that has been evolving since the end of the campaign between President Trump and the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen. There are reports that Gary Cohn, the chairman of the National Economic Council that we mentioned earlier, a Goldman Sachs alum, has been trying to midwife an improved relationship between the president and Janet Yellen. What can you share with us about where that stands and whether there's likely to be a new chairman of the Fed appointed by President Trump?
Well, it would not be in the president's interest to come out blustering and replace the Fed chairman. It would give the markets a tummy ache, and so he's not likely to do that. He's toned down his rhetoric. It's been pointed out to him that both the chairman and the president were born within a couple of months of each other in different boroughs of New York, not at great distance. They have differing economic philosophies. The president wants faster growth. The chairman believes that economic growth should be in the 2% range. That's the maximum we can do without stressing the system. The president thinks we should do 3% or 4%. So I think it will come to a head at some point. It's just not going to come to a head, in my opinion, immediately. And we watched the president, and when he was running for office, he and Ted Cruz were best buddies 1 week because they were in agreement, and a week later they were attacking one another. And right now, I think Chairman Yellen is safe. I don't know that she will be reappointed, though. I think that when he gets the opportunity to appoint a new Fed chairman, he will look for someone that will focus on faster growth, which is what he's after.
And as I understand it, she has the option of staying on the Fed, even if she ceases to be its chairman. Is that right?
That's a fair question. I don't have an immediate answer, but I know there are three open positions on the Fed. So the president is going to be able to reshape the Fed with his appointments anyway.
Do you anticipate, given what you've said, Kevin, that we're likely to see continuing sort of cutting back on the so-called quantitative easing that Janet Yellen presided over?
I think they're ready. I think the Fed overall is ready. They're going to allow interest rates. They're going to bring interest rates up. The market may not be ready, but the Fed is ready to raise interest rates where they have control. And I think that they will, as the bonds mature that they've bought, they will shrink their balance sheet by just buying less of them in the market. So if $20 billion worth of bonds mature, they might buy $17 billion more in the market as they slowly bleed off their balance sheet. And we'll see how the market responds to it. Right now, the market seems addicted to the crack cocaine of easy money, and nobody's worried about any of the things we've talked about. They look at the stock markets, the market's at a new all-time high.
Kevin Freeman, we're very grateful for your time, much of it today, and we look forward to continuing the conversation with you as we do each week. But I think we need to make a regular feature of these longer conversations because there is so much going on in your portfolio. And we'll look forward to watching about it at the Blaze Network with the new program, Kevin Freeman's Economic War Room. Stay tuned for it, as well as more from us tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.